guys, and welcome back to episode 237 of the OCDstories.com podcast. In this episode, I chat with Dr. Emily O'Leary. Emily is based in Australia, and I got her on the show to talk about all things OCD treatment, how she approaches the treatment of OCD, sticking points within ERP, content versus process of OCD, avoiding pitfalls of circular arguments, when you and your child has OCD, living with uncertainty, and much, much more. So thank you so much to Emily for her time, and of course to you guys for listening. And a quick shout out to our podcast partners, NoCD. NoCD Therapy matches you with a licensed therapist trained to treat OCD, offers a personalized treatment plan, delivered through face-to-face video therapy sessions. Between therapy sessions, you can use their therapeutic tools in the app 24/7, message your therapist, and learn what helps other people in their OCD peer community. To find out more, head to go.treatmyocd.com/theocdstories or click the link in the episode description. Now on to the show. On the podcast today, I have Dr. Emily O'Leary. Emily is a clinical psychologist and founder of four psychology clinics, including the OCD Clinic Brisbane and Anxiety House. Welcome to the podcast, Emily.
Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you here, especially at this early hour for you. It's commitment.
I know. It's massive commitment, isn't it?
It is.
I set the alarm actually an hour early because I was freaked out I was going to sleep through it. Not the best look. So, yeah, I've actually been up for an hour.
Well, I appreciate you showing up. Your therapy story, you know, is as little as much detail as you want to share. You know, why become, why get into therapy, and then why specifically with OCD?
Look, it's a bit of a roundabout story. I initially actually just kind of traveled the world for about 5 years after school because I always knew I wanted to go into psychology, but I really was sick of school, so I just wanted to travel a little bit. When I went back to university, I had the intention of turning into someone like Jodie Foster and becoming, you know, a criminal profiler because I've been watching a lot of movies. And over the years of getting into psychology and finding what I kind of fit with, I ended up actually going into psychosis and early intervention and work there. And when I was in that area, I met, there were quite a few people that actually had dual diagnosis of psychosis and OCD, and some people that had OCD was what was called back in that day, it sounds like I'm 100, but a long time ago, with poor insight. So it was kind of like they had delusional quality to it. And I really connected with this sort of cohort, and we really started, we just connected kind of on a personal level and on a professional level, because these people were like super smart. You know, pre their episode, they were nailing life. And then all of a sudden they had this stuff going on, you know, like I'm worried I've run someone over. And I'm like, yeah, but you haven't. Yeah, but I'm worried I am. Yeah, but you haven't. Look at the car. But I still think I have. And I'm like, I don't get this. Like you were, you know, this was your job, and it was like this massive puzzle. And then we kind of bumbled our way through because back in the day, OCD – it was kind of like it was something that was taught alongside anxiety and depression, but we didn't really deep dive into it really at university. So I sort of had to unpack that. And the more I got into this and the more I got to know these people, I just kind of fell in love with it because these group of people, and you know, I apologize for kind of just grouping everyone together, but they were so motivated. They were so like, come on, I want to just get in, get this done. I want to go back to life. And it just really connected with both of us as a team, just going boom. And I really started to notice some good results. And then they were just, you know, really appreciative. And I was just loving being a therapist. To be honest, that's how it evolved. It was just like this love story between me and this treatment and the people behind the disorder. And that's how it kind of just, how I went into it. And then I went into, I thought, well, I better actually really understand this. And then I went into a PhD in it, which was traumatic and beautiful at the same time because I spent way too long doing it. So that's kind of the long version of how I ended up being an OCD therapist. And that was, I don't know, 15, 16 years ago. And I often get asked, like, don't you get sick of seeing people with OCD every day? You know, because that's been my life. And I can honestly say no. Like for me, going to work, and actually, like I genuinely look forward to it. I genuinely look forward to it. And I will see 6 or 7 clients a day. And at the end of the day, I actually don't. I mean, some days, obviously, because you're juggling kids and family and life, you feel tired. But I don't feel mentally tired because I genuinely just love this group. Anyway, it's really long version to your question. But that's awesome. How I sort of got into it.
Yeah, no, thank you for sharing. And yeah, I agree. So, you know, I can relate somewhat in terms of the podcast. You know, I'm 200, well, the time that we're recording this, I'm 220-something episodes. And, you know, by episode 30, I was like, in theory, I've covered everything that I need to in terms of giving people some information. But there are so many intricacies and so many like avenues you can go down. It's kind of never ending.
Exactly. And I think the other thing that spurs me on is that you also meet people that have been treated badly or gone down the wrong pathway or started a therapy that kind of backfired or have just been down an avenue that they shouldn't. And it's that, and I think because of that, there was a real need to learn how to treat OCD well. And I think that that's something that I was really passionate about because I'd had a number of stories come back around either rushing into ERP too soon or someone really freaking out at sexual thoughts or harm thoughts and kind of mirroring that anxiety back to the client, the client kind of leaving going, oh my God, you know, I'm just horrible deviant. And, you know, just stock standard stuff that if they had the basic understanding of OCD, they wouldn't have done, but they didn't realize how damaging that is, because then you actually have to go back and unpack that, self-correct it, and then actually get back and put them on a proper treatment path.
Yeah, I agree. And I've heard that too many times. And and then you're also trying to undo the trauma and the negative impact of that therapeutic experience.
Absolutely.
Getting them to trust you now. You know, why are you any different, so to speak, could be the belief. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay, so now thank you for that. What was your ERP? What was your PhD thesis on?
Okay, so it was really like going down the rabbit hole. So I did a PhD on whether you could really hone down and profile, back to Jodie Foster, I suppose, the underlying core beliefs alongside content-based subtypes and OCD. So, you know, we often know that things like thought action fusion and inflated responsibility beliefs play with the harm-related OCD. And so what I really wanted to do is to firmly show, okay, look, there's these really strong profiles and therefore, you know, we can kind of circumvent a lot of time and just jump straight into, you know, behavioural experiments around blah, blah, blah. And whilst I always go deep into ERP, I probably at a heart, I'm more of a, I love Paul Selkowski's work and Adam Radomski and Rackman, sort of the cognitive appraisal process in terms of how you're approaching these thoughts and all the cognitive stuff that you can get lost in. And so I really wanted to bring that to my therapy so that people weren't just having a, here's some techniques, here's some EAP, go and play, blah, blah, because even though you get symptom relief from that, often it would, you know, that's where relapse comes in. If you don't fully understand theories for underpinnings of this stuff, if you don't sort of have, it's almost kind of like the mojo. Look, you just got to really understand and have your mindset right for when you're going into this stuff, because it is going to be tough and we need to stick it through, and then you've got to carry that mindset post. So the end result was a bit mucky in terms of the PhD, because as much as I wanted to find these really strong correlations, essentially found that the beliefs that the obsessive compulsive cognitions working group that sort of outlined in 96, which is, you know, they were saying things like responsibility and uncertainty and control and perfectionism, and all of those were what we called OCD relevant. I wanted to try and find them OCD specific. They didn't. It's still OCD relevant, which probably really just confirms that content's really irrelevant, and whether you're harm or whether you're contamination based or those types of things, actually all of these beliefs are going to interplay. So that was the learning in itself. But yeah, look, it got some good traction. It was the largest study in New Zealand. And I think I probably got a bit lost in that. It's like, okay, I just want to get a really good study. It's got to be, you know, enough sample, because I was always comparing, because New Zealand's a tiny wee country, right? So I was like looking at at these countries that are much bigger and the populations of working with OCD. So I think my PhD in the end, I think it took about 3 or 4 years, 2 more years than it needed to. But hey, it's a good wee book stopper.
Yeah.
I look back. But yeah, I learned a lot from it. And it's certainly, I think having that research and theoretical base is super helpful, bringing that to the table in my treatment with people with OCD.
Yeah. No, I agree. And thank you for explaining that. And so you've definitely started to explain your my next question was going to be on your approach to treating OCD. So is there anything else you want to add to kind of what you've already said?
Yeah, humour and authenticity. Yeah. I think that the proper treatment protocol for OCD is really good now. Like, there's some great protocols. So anyone can, you know, that has got the proper training can essentially go through that. What I think is the layer, though, with OCD is that there's such a lot of shame and guilt that trust is a huge issue. And if they sense that you're kind of going through the motions, or you genuinely don't care or something like that, you're not going to get a look in. So I think it's being, if you're a therapist that's quite straight-laced, be a therapist that's quite straight-laced. If you're a therapist like myself, that's probably not, that's a little bit of reverence, that will use humour day-to-day, do that, because that's who you are. And if that connects with you, great. But I think sometimes, you know, we try and change ourselves in terms of therapeutic style. I think the one thing when you're working with OCD is that you have to be 100% authentic and genuine, which is probably the same as with every person that has mental health difficulties. But I think particularly for OCD, they're testing you to see whether you're going to be able to hold their stuff in that room without freaking out and genuinely go, yeah, okay, I've got you. Right, this is what I'm thinking.
Yeah.
So I think that's super important. And I use a lot of humour in session, because the content of the stuff, you know, that's hardcore. Like, you know, and sometimes it's the first time that they would have talked about it. And, you know, it's not like they disclose and then I make a joke, but it's more as the therapy and the relationship continues, you develop your own way of talking about it. You know, and we do. We end up giggling about, you know, morphine or 2 years ago. And I said, do you remember 2 years ago when you know, you were that serial killer and now you're this? You know, what are your thoughts on that? You know, we kind of use it in a jest way. And it helps diffuse, I think, a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. And it helps change that scary current relationship to the thoughts and the content, to when you can see them at a distance, you can see them as being a bit more absurd. And yeah.
Yeah. And again, I think it's picking up and reading what that client needs, because, you know, that's a kind of middle to end point where I start using that. A lot of the time it's not even dealing with OCD in those initial stages. It's dealing with, yes, you can trust me. Yes, I'm not going to judge you. Yes, you know, all of that kind of trust, guilt, shame, I've got this stuff, I'm a horrible person, what if people find out stuff? And it's that process and that dance until they go, yeah, okay, and then you go into treatment. Yeah.
Yeah, no,
that's kind of my approach. And from a theoretical perspective, it's really ACT, CBT, metacognitive therapy, hardcore behavior therapy, and that I probably don't deviate from those four.
And are they kind of evenly split, or is it more one thing over the other?
Depends who walks in the door. You know, so I'm really case formulation driven. So someone will come in, and first off, we get a sense of, okay, are we going to fit? Is it a good thing? And I generally do a little bit of a screen on the phone, but you can tell who's going to gel with whom. And really, it's doing a really good case formulation, understanding that person's story. And then depending on their personality and what I think that what they may have tried, like a lot of people will say, oh my God, I just please do not give me CBT again, or do not tell me to do deep breathing, I'm over it. And then I go, okay, let's try this particular pathway. So it really depends on who's sitting in front of me and what they've tried and what I think could be useful.
Yeah, no, thank you. Yeah, makes sense. Okay, so let's, yeah, for you know, you mentioned metacognitive therapy there, and that's not something that's really come up on the podcast before. So I guess anyone that's not familiar with it, just to kind of explain what that is and how you'd use it.
Yeah, look, it's based on Adrian Wells's model. And look, I'm probably really more, to be honest, more sitting in ACT and CBT, but metacognitive therapy in a way is predominantly, it's almost like the easiest way to explain it is that you've got a brain kind of like a brain watching your thoughts, like it's like a second brain in a way. And it's we often talk about thought action fusion in that, you know, your thoughts are fusing together and you're making judgments on these particular thoughts. It's like that sort of cognitive appraisal process. And what we do often is around disrupting that process between the metacognition, say, of thought action fusion or control or uncertainty. And we just disrupt that process between that and judging on the content of the thought and look at it that way. So yeah, I mean, it's quite a specific type of therapy, but look, you know, I'd use that with different types of people, but predominantly I think my focus is more ACT or CBT.
Yeah.
But it's something that we do have a number of metacognitive therapists in the clinic. It's quite big, actually, in New Zealand. A lot of our and that was after my time. So I kind of tail end and look at what they're doing. Oh, that's really interesting. But then probably being more trained traditionally in CBT, and then I think as a in recent years getting more interested in ACT. That's something that I've gone into. But I like Wells's model, and also for generalized anxiety disorder, where they look at type 1, type 2 worry, which is, you know, again looking at content and process based stuff. So again, it's about going, okay, you're making these judgments, you're fusing with these thoughts. How do we get out of that cycle? How do we do that?
Yeah. No, thank you for that. That's interesting. And is Wells English? Am I right in saying
yes?
That? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, there's, I think, you know, definitely in the UK, you guys do OCD really well. There's so many, you know, really good researchers and therapists. Like all of my gurus when I was little were in the UK. Awesome. I was a massive, I remember meeting Paul Savkoskis at a conference, and I was just like starstruck. He was like, he was Bruce Springsteen. I was like, wow. Yeah, pretty amazing.
Yeah,
oh, that's awesome. I remember watching a video at the House of Obsessive Compulsives, which actually just was, you know, really hardcore ERP. But I remember the way and his style of therapy, it was great. He was just such a normal human being, but also a therapist. Yeah.
Yeah. Now I've seen him at a couple of OCD UK's conferences. No, that's awesome. And, Let's go on to ACT then. So my audience should hopefully, as long as they listen to more than one episode, should be familiar with ACT. I do talk about it from time to time. How are you using it? Obviously it's going to change, but generally speaking, how are you using it in sessions?
So I think in a way, I predominantly rely on ACT techniques. My main focus in terms of using ACT is really around things like choice point and diffusion. So from a technique point of view and how I'd approach a case, it kind of looks like that the meat and bones of treatment and wrestling with the different thoughts for me is a lot about labeling and diffusion, labeling and diffusion. I actually don't veer away from that. I don't go into thought challenging in terms of evidence-based stuff. For me, my experience with OCD is you actually go down the rabbit hole with that. And if the thought is particularly illogical, I don't see the difference. So I don't see it being beneficial to apply evidence to something that's completely illogical. Now, the difference is that and, say, corrective information, like Ross Menzies, an Australian, has programs around dirt and stuff like this, quite cognitive in nature. And corrective information is things like, you know, if we're looking at the AIDS virus, you might go, okay, well, the AIDS virus is, you know, that's quite a fragile virus, and you might give this person all the facts if they don't know, right? That's different to challenging. And I initially started off challenging, and that's why I went into ACT, because, you know, we would do likelihoods or probabilities or stuff, and it'd just be really circular. And so that's why I moved more into assessment, really strong formulation, shared understanding, process. Okay, let's do skill building. So we do grounding, labeling, diffusion. So that's my ACT-based stuff, a little bit of values-based works, getting their mojo up for ERP, hit them with ERP, rely on the diffusion techniques to cheerlead through, which is, and that's what I often say, like, these techniques are not designed to make you feel better. And I wish I could. Only Valium will do that. What these techniques are designed to do is cheerlead and hold you through ERP, which is where you're going to get the bang for your buck. You know, so, and then it's ERP, behavioral experiments, blah, 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 blah. So ACT is my kind of, this is where we're going to have stuff we can rely on, sense of self-efficacy, value, bring it up, cheerlead, exposure.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. And do you ever use metaphors or anything like that in session?
Yeah, sometimes. Sometimes I find some of the ACT stuff, I can only go so far with some ACT stuff. Yeah. Like, because then I go, because again, it comes back to the authenticity, right?
Yeah.
So there's some stuff that just wouldn't come out of my mouth, right? Because it would just sound cheesy.
Yeah.
Or it would sound like, really, that's not you. But I do like the things of the cars on a highway, standing on the side, cars on a highway coming and going. I can't use the leaves because everyone's sick of bloody leaves on a stream. They don't want to hear about any more leaves on a stream. But they don't mind the cars on the highway or the person driving the bus. Or probably the one I use the biggest is just one we came up with, which was the big glass walls. At the side of your head. And I often say, look, it's like you've got these big glass walls side of your head and they've got all this rubbish at you. You know, you're a horrible devo, blah, 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 blah. And it's just slamming you, right? You can turn around, you can see it. It's behind the glass walls. You're looking at it, but you're just safe in your zone, right? You're just seeing it. You don't have to do anything with it. You're just big, solid glass walls. You're in your zone. You're just going to do what you need to do. So you're not going to thought stop. It's just going to be there. You're just going to focus on what you need to do, not in a distraction way. You're still citing it. It's just there. And I use that kind of thing quite a bit. For some lads I've done, look, we're putting it in the boot, car's driving off, come on, it's done. It's in the boot, let's go. So to be honest, in terms of metaphors, I use whatever is useful to them, meaningful to them, but default back to my walls.
Yeah. Yeah, no, cool. I appreciate that. And I haven't heard that metaphor before. And yeah, like you said, you've got to be congruent with who you are, otherwise it just won't work. Okay, so I want to ask you a question around ERP. So we're ticking all the boxes.
Sure.
What are some of the sticking points you've found when doing ERP? And I know that's a very vague question, but anything that comes to mind.
Tapes. Yeah. They don't want to do it.
Yeah.
the dropout's huge. It's about 60%. Wow. So ERP is a fantastic therapy. It's just awful a lot of the time. And because of that, we have to get people in the mindset to go, yep, it's awful, but it's so worth it. So mindset's super important. So getting people to the point where they see the benefit in short-term pain, long-term gain. So I think that's really important. Not rushing into it is also, I think, important. Also having a shared understanding. Sometimes I see there's a disconnect between how you're measuring how a person is going. So are you going to measure how anxious they are, or are you going to use how likely or how willing they are to engage in the experiment? So those things pre are important. During it, look, you know, people with OCD will often say that 100% in, but then when we're in a situation and if I'm there loitering somewhere in the background, you know, the sneaky little covert compulsions come in, safety seeking behaviors, and that's sometimes, like, often it's not consciously, they just do it. Because you human beings have a innate thing to protect themselves. So let's say I'm just thinking one, you know, I think one of the a behavior experiments I did was not going away from exposure, but a client had to walk down the main street. They were convinced I'd stab people. And it was around having the arms. You had to walk with your arms like this. And I was tracking them behind. And then I noticed starting well, and it also made it at lunchtime, so everyone had to come up for lunch, so the streets were really packed. And again, you know, then the hands started going in pockets, and then the hands, I noted the postures coming and stuff like that, so we had to stop, we had to regroup, we had to, and watching all of these types of things. So those things I think are important, but also looking at, So the neutralizing aspect is important, but also making sure that people aren't checking out of the exposure too early. Like, people literally have to stay in that space for the anxiety to drop before they obviously leave. A lot of people will actually just kind of go, okay, I've done the exposure, and then exit too quickly and then inadvertently reinforce the thing that they're trying to challenge.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
It does, yeah.
Yeah.
No, thank you for that. That's that's really interesting, especially the behavioral experiment bit. Okay, so you've touched on this already, but in your course you run for professionals, so mental health professionals, one of the points on it was differentiating between content and process of OCD. So if you could just sort of unpack that.
Sure. So I think this is one of the fundamental things in treatment, I believe, with OCD, is that people get just caught up in content and that they put way too much emphasis on it. And it's slightly contentious that whilst I know people, it creates a sense of meaning when people go, I'm ROCD, I'm HOCD, I'm POCD. And I get that. We get that a lot in the clinic, and it's actually a way of, I think, testing therapists that they actually know what OCD is about. And I get that. I always, when I train people, I say, look, they're going to say this. This means this, this, and this, this. Know this, otherwise you won't get a look in. Yeah. So while I think there's a sense of purpose and meaning around that, it's also, I think, difficult because it will change each year. Really, or, you know, every couple of months, it can be super quick. And if you just focus on content, you're going to be in therapy for the rest of your life. So content is largely irrelevant, and it's really around how you're seeing your thoughts. And I think the more important meaning is to kind of go that it's really about thoughts being mad, bad, and dangerous. Mm. You know, your thoughts are really important, and because of that, it's about trying to disengage from it and thinking it doesn't matter whether it says to you X, Y, and Z. It's about that it's always going to kind of hook you in.
So what are the pitfalls of circular arguments and covert reassurance, or how to avoid them?
I think that's the biggest thing in OCD, is that circular argument that people get in. And I genuinely think that people believe that they can outsmart, out-argue OCD, and you can't, and you need to accept that. Yeah. You will never win an argument, or if you win an argument, you'll only do it for about 5 minutes, and then it'll hit you with something else. So it's super important that they drop the arguments. Yes, that's hard. Yes, it's like a mosquito bite that you just have to scratch and you don't. But the more you actually apply attention to that thought or give that thought pure behaviorism, the more frequency of thoughts you're going to get. And fundamentally, it's about starving the beast. We just have to starve the beast and go, as much as I actually want to argue and tell you all of the reasons why I'm not, you know, just this horrible, you know, sadistic person, you don't and you can't, because A, you don't need to, And B, it's about just really unhooking and going, hey, it could be that thought, that thought, that thought, going back to content-based stuff. Super important to unhook, come back to center and go, yep, okay, all of those things floating out there, I don't need, I'm not responsible for managing them or problem solving them. And that is the biggest thing I think people have to get their head around, is they genuinely think that because it's in their head, they have to do something with it. You don't. And that they can, if given enough time and evidence, put it to bed. You can't. So, it's a huge thing. It's a huge thing. It's the biggest maintaining factor, I think, in OCD. But it's one of the most important things to get straight in your head that you will never win with that particular line of problem solving. Can you use that problem solving technique in real life? Absolutely, go for gold. You can, project manage everything. I'm sure you're perfect using that, but you can't do it with OCD. That problem solving strategy will not work.
Yeah. Yeah, no, thank you for that. The one always comes to mind for me is I always say, let's say, for example, OCD is a world champion tennis player and you're never going to beat it at tennis, but it sucks at football or soccer, And if you play at that game, that's how you win it. And it's kind of finding, if you keep playing into what you're saying, you're just going to keep losing.
Absolutely. And again, it's about it sucking your time and energy. That's what it's doing. It's just taking all your time and energy and saying, thanks very much. And I think the hard one is that when I talk like this, I can almost like get that sense that clients are going, yeah, but it's easy for you, Emily. You don't have OCD. Like, in my head. And I'm like, I'm not, but I've worked with enough of you to see that this is not going to work, it's not going to play out, and I genuinely want you to have your time back, which is why you have to take the short-term hit. And sometimes you literally see people in the chair almost white-knuckling. They're going, yeah, I know, I'm not going to do it. I'm like, no, you're not. Just let it sit. And sometimes it'll be like that. But I will often say, if you can just do it that initial 5 minutes, just starve it, it will actually start to drip off. But if you go straight away into it, you're lost. As soon as you get that kind of, it's there, oh, am I going to do it? Am I not? You just keep starve, then it gets easier to unhook.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
You know, absolutely it does. I just got like a million metaphors coming into my head. That's how my brain works. I agree. I love that. It does. It makes perfect sense. It's just kind of, again, waiting for the storm to pass, but trusting the storm's not going to kill you, so to speak. You've got to have that
absolutely
faith.
Yeah. It's a nice way of putting it.
No, thank you. I had another metaphor around a tiger, but I won't go into that.
You can save the tiger one for later.
I will. So on Anxiety House, there's a blog post, Anxiety House being one of your clinics. I believe it's you that wrote it, which was, it was titled, What If You and Your Child Has OCD? Now, this is a very good topic, and I'm sure it happens in many instances. What are some key points around, I guess, for any mums or dads that are wondering this, my son, daughter has OCD and I have it.
Yep.
What are some tips for me?
I think first one, drop the guilt. A lot of parents have this thing that they've got bad genes, they've passed bad genes on. The reality is it's Russian roulette, right? So I've seen people, like two parents have OCD, kids don't. I've seen kids that have OCD, nothing in the family. Yes, it runs in families. Yes, there's a chance. But again, it's coming back to, there's chances of lots of things, whether it's diabetes or anxiety and depression, rah-de-rah. You know, it's not about bad genes. It's Russian roulette. If you get it, you get it. You get in early and you offset the development. So I always work a lot with that guilt factor, whether it's from mum or dad. And then secondly, it's boundaries. Okay, so you need to know your mental health. You need to know their mental health, and they're both going to be different. So, if you are a parent with OCD, you 100% have to be across your own mental health. And that's why the guilt stuff is super important. But looking at your modelling, what are you modelling? What compulsions are you doing, not doing? Because they're all watching. And this is what I say to people, super important. If you're looking at having kids, you know this is a bit of an issue. Just do a bit of an audit on yourself. because kids do watch and they think that that is then the normal, that you do wash your hands X, Y, and Z, that you do, you know, all of this stuff. That so knowing your mental health, knowing where your boundaries are, and then also I think being aware of the development, potential development for OCD, but also not being oversensitive to it. So sometimes parents with OCD will misinterpret or overread into their kids, like, oh, you know, and I'll get, you know, the clinic's been around a while. So, you know, I'll get phone calls from old clients that have had kids and they're like, you know, little Johnny's doing this. He's age three, you know, to think I should be worried. And I'm like, well, you know, sometimes just compulsive behaviors are compulsive behaviors. Kids are hugely repetitive at different ages and at different points. And so it's taking a very mindful approach to that, but not overreading. Just because you have OCD doesn't mean your child's going to have OCD. But if you both have OCD, then again, it's about having a shared language and it's making it developmentally mentally appropriate. So if that child has been confirmed and diagnosed OCD, then it's using things like OCD as the bully, OCD, you know, got this worry monster, if that works for them. It's externalizing the disorder. Essentially, it's using the very same kind of CBT ACT approaches as you would, but changing the language. And again, it's about a team effort. It's like it's us versus, you know, how's it going today? Sometimes it's, you know, I'll suggest every couple of days or on set days having OCD check-ins. How are you going with that, you know? And again, it's showing your children that, yeah, yes, you might have OCD, but you know your life. Like OCD is something you manage. It doesn't need to impact your life to... you know, to the points we always see. It's actually something that can actually just be well managed if you're across it. And even if you do have those episodes and relapses, which of course that's OCD, it's episodic, then you go, okay, there's been an episode, there's been a trigger, manage it, get back, and just, you know, kind of stay the course. So I think the biggest thing when it comes to, you know, having a child that has OCD and then the person has OCD is around insight, boundaries. And then taking a consistent approach. Like it's not like there has to be one treatment for the adult and one treatment for the child. Evidence-based therapy is evidence-based therapy. The difference is language and delivery.
Yeah, no, thank you for that. That's really interesting points. And also the bit you said about the start, about drop the guilt. You talk about diabetes and stuff. It's a good point because, you know, I've met many people with diabetes and that, you know, throughout their family, I've seen that. And I've never seen or heard someone say, oh, I'm so ashamed I gave my kid diabetes, or it's in their genetic makeup, you know, through my DNA, they got it. And, or, you know, I wear glasses. It's like me saying, I'm so ashamed I gave my kid, you know, 100%. Poor eyesight. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah,
it's odd and that we do really that with important. Mental health.
Of course, and it is like any other thing that can run in families, mm-hmm. you know. And if we all decided, you know, that we wouldn't have kids because there's something in our family, you know, it would be, you know, a population would dwindle significantly. Yeah. You know, I'm usually actually quite surprised when I do an assessment and I get to mental health and they go, yeah, no, we're good. And I said, what do you mean? What about aunties, uncles, grandparents, you know? No, nothing. Right. Okay. Never.
There's lots of denial.
Yeah, because there's always something. Yeah. And whether that's stated or not stated, like statistically, there is always something in someone's family. You know, if you look at the statistics, it's going to be something. And if it's not, they'll say things like, oh, no, no mental health issues. We did have some alcohol and drug issues. I'm like, really? Okay, hello, self-medication. But, you know, back in the day, I think as well, you know, for our grandparents' generation, for example, that was so hard for them because their options were, like, go into some horrible hospital and take a whole lot of psychotropic kind of drugs and hardcore drugs or not feed the family. Like, there wasn't a lot of choices. So a lot of people used to self-medicate.
Yeah.
A lot of people self-medicate today for anxiety.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Okay, so just general question now. Just words of wisdom for living with uncertainty.
Just thinking the easiest way to say that.
Um,
I think it's more around there's no choice, so get on with it. I think how inspiring is that? But again, part of being part of this world and being a human being means that that is just what it is, right? Life is inherently uncertain. To try and circumvent that and create control creates drama. You know, if you're trying to go, I hate feeling anxious, I just want to feel in control, and you micromanage your life or you micromanage your body in terms of eating disorders or other areas or your partner, you're always going to create drama. So life is inherently uncertain, and that's a feeling that makes us uncomfortable, and I get that, and I wish we could make it easier, but we can't. So we've got to be smart. It's just about being smart. You know, if someone says, okay, this is the playing field, you're here and you've got to get over here. You know, you don't want to just sit there and laboriously think about it. You've got to go, okay, be smart. How do I get from there to there? Now do it. Is it going to be painful? Potentially, yes. But you're going to waste time otherwise. You don't want to waste time in life. You know, it's not a dress rehearsal. You've got to get out there and smash it. So take the hit.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's no. – but that's the way I kind of play it, and that's the way I encourage my clients to do it. It's like, yes, is it going to suck 100%? Mm. Okay. Do we want to embrace that now so we can get to the goodies? Okay, how are we going to do that?
Yes, I like it. No, thank you. and then, so just, I always ask questions, just words of hope for people with OCD. So it could be like words of hope generally or words of hope around the treatment.
Yeah. Look, to be honest, I just had so many come to mind. I just want to say, firstly, you know, it's, I always hate talking about it as a group, but I think people's OCD are awesome. Awesome, bright, motivated, empathetic. The reason that you've got this thing is because you care too much about stuff and people. That makes you awesome. But it's just getting unhooked from that stuff in your head. You can 100% do this, but you've got to be smart about it. As much as you want to go and have a chat to the beast, you can't. You've got to be smart. Don't let it rob you of your life. In the past, it was that, you know, OCD was always this like chronic and refractory illness, and it was, you know, It's not like it's hard. Don't get me wrong. I see the pain in people's lives and what it can do, but 100% you can smash this. You just have to be consistent and really follow the right sort of evidence-based advice and play the long game.
Yeah. Excellent. And so you can pick up the phone and call the 20-year-old Emily. What would you tell her?
Stay the course. Like, I mean, I think I would say, well, probably at 20, I was actually still traveling and having great time in your country, actually. Okay. But I think I would say 100%, this is an amazing career and an absolute privilege to work with this group of people. And I would say that they potentially have a lot more to teach me than the other way, you know, because I'm just blown away by people with OCD, their resilience, right? Because a lot of the time they've got families and they've got their careers, which everyone has, and then they have the secret life over here of stuff in their head. So they've got three jobs. Most people have two. They've got three jobs and they still do everything really well. So I think it's more... I really wouldn't say change anything. I'd just say enjoy the ride. Because all the times, you know, that I may have stuffed up a little bit in therapy or gone too hard with the IP or gone too soon or, you know, it's still learning for me. It's a way of learning and starting as a CBT therapist and doing all the stuff I was taught, you know, that taught me kind of what not to do sometimes. And I've had the most amazing therapeutic relationships with clients, you know, that have lasted 10 years, that bounce back. Yeah, because I often do a course of therapy and then, you know, it'll be that sort of 16 sessions. And then there are, of course, people that take a lot longer. And I hate sort of putting time limits on it because people compare themselves. Like, well, how long did it take you? How long did it? But after the sort of main chunk of it, they will go away and live and then they might pop back a year later. Or I've got clients that have been with me and they still see me every 2 months. And it's not actually about OCD, it's just life, chickens, what's happening, stuff. And I think, for me, I'd just say, well, you know, good choice. It's a privilege to work with this group of people. And maybe take some of my own advice. I think as therapists, we're often seen as like having all our stuff together, you know, and I like the fact that sometimes I'll hear myself saying things around uncertainty or control, and then you go, hey, you know, stop trying to control your own life in these different ways. Mm. So I think you also got to walk.
Cool. Good breakdown. And then lastly, so you've got a billboard in Brisbane. What do you want written on that billboard?
Smash it. Nice. You know, as regards to OCD, it's always just been smash it.
Yeah.
You know, it's got to be, you are stronger than OCD. Mm. You don't feel it. You feel like it's got you, but it hasn't. It can't survive without you. Mm. If you don't play, it can't play.
Yeah, I like it. No, that's really good. And it's a good slogan for life. Just smash it.
Yeah, that's pretty much my slogan, which sometimes works and sometimes doesn't. Yeah.
Cool. Is there anything else that you wish you could have said today?
For the people out there with the harm and sexual thoughts, right, I know you guys are freaked out about going and getting treatment because you think that someone's going to turn around, take your kids, judge you, call the police. If you're super anxious about these thoughts and you absolutely hate them, you 100%, you know, need to go and get treatment. That a really well-trained OCD therapist, this is like stock standard walk in the park stuff, right? Mm. So get treatment, stop sitting there in silence, stop thinking you're the worst person in the world. That, you know, these are very common, typical thoughts in OCD. And as therapists, we know that. We just want to help you. We're not going to judge you.
Yeah, well said. Thank you for sharing. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate you sharing everything you shared. It's been awesome. So there you have it. Thank you so much to Emily for her time. And, of course, to you guys for listening. I deeply appreciate it. And don't forget, today's episode is sponsored by NoCD. To find out more about NoCD and their therapy plans, head over to go.treatmyocd.com/theocdstories or visit the link in the episode description. And quick disclaimer, guys, this podcast is not therapy. It is not a replacement for therapy. Please seek treatment from a trained professional. Until we speak, take care.